Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to your podcast, New Books in Economic and Business History. I'm your host, Javier Mejia from Stanford University. And today I have the great pleasure to be with Clara Mattei. She's an assistant professor in the economics department of the New School for Social Research. And she's the author of a book that has received quite a lot of attention recently. It's called The Capital Order, How Economists Invented Austerity and Paved the Way to Fascism. I'm going to be talking with Clara today about her book and her career. Hi, Clara. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you so much for having me.
I'm very excited. And before getting into the book, I would like to hear more about you. I would like to hear about how you ended up being the scholar that you are today, interested in the topics that you work on. So please tell me a bit about that. Where are you from? How did you end up being this type of social scientist that you are?
Thanks so much. I have quite a peculiar, academic trajectory, in the sense that I've started as a philosophy student. So I did a BA and an MA in philosophy and history. In Italy, philosophy is quite continental, so it's interlinked with a lot of history courses. And then I took a class in the history of economic thought with a wonderful professor who now passed away, Giorgio Lunghini, and he got me very interested in reading the classics. So Smith, Ricardo, Marx, Sraffa. And he thought I was a good student, so he pushed me to actually getting to a PhD in economics. And I had a completely different understanding of what economics could be. So I was quite shocked when I started the hardcore mathematics and quantitative classes. So it was very difficult. I spent 4 years. We did a lot of exams, mainstream methods. And after I passed all my classes, I wanted to really reaffirm the fact that even someone with a background in philosophy could make it in a PhD in economics. I was doubtful on how I could make sense of my research project. And I actually encountered an article on fascist economic policies quite randomly. And I was living in the 2011-2012 post-sovereign debt crisis austerity moment with Mario Monti in government. And there I realized the parallelism. So I got curious and I started exploring, and I finally found out there is a whole world of people who try to go beyond the strict disciplinary boundaries. And I constructed for myself kind of a framework in historical political economy. Now, this has a lot to do also with the fact that I got hired at the New School right after my PhD, and that really helped me so much put together the historical archival work that I had done during my PhD thesis with a conceptual framework that is embedded in the classical political economy tradition. And so in this sense, this book is in fact history, theory, and in general trying to understand the logic of capitalism through a historical perspective.
Let me ask you a bit more about that, about the, again, I think you're a special type of economist, right? And your background as a philosopher is probably like at the core of that difference. And now I would like to know how do you feel like navigating like the social dimension of your profession? And I guess what I'm thinking is that I'm not sure like how much space is for, on a daily basis, at least for philosophy and reflection of ideas in our community. And probably this is particularly the case in the American economics community, right? So how do you feel about that? Have you ever felt like orphaned in terms of, or like misplaced, feeling that you're not in the right place? Like, I guess that the New School is a very special institution as well. Like, but I would like to hear a bit like about your personal experience.
And oh, definitely. It was very tough for me. I was crying almost every day. My family still makes fun of me remembering the time during my PhD years, in which, in fact, even an institution like the one I was in Italy, Sant'Anna University, heterodox in name, had a hard time accepting a framework that was constructed out of historical and analysis that was interested in the social relations that constitute our economy. So I felt extremely misplaced until I actually got the opportunity to learn about the existence of the New School and luckily enough got hired there, in which in fact it is one of the only places, unfortunately for us, unfortunately for general, for the profession, and luckily for me, who is there at the moment, in which the idea is that history is constitutive of economic theory, that you can't divide, you can't do abstract theory without a historical understanding. And so in this sense, they appreciate scholars who really try to gain insight from historical processes. And this is quite unique. And, you know, the New School, unfortunately, is small, has not much funding. We are going through a big labor strike at the moment because there's a structural underfunding of professors. So, you know, it's one has to defend this tradition also very concretely in the type of resources we have. But certainly, you know, I gave up participating in the big economic conferences of, you know, the mainstream economic conferences because I have interests that are quite different in the sense that I feel that sometimes our profession can become extremely intellectually dry, not only because it presumes to be apolitical. And this is one of the themes of the book, is to try to really discover through the direct participation of economists in the class struggle after the First World War, is really to uncover kind of the political nature of the supposedly apolitical discipline of economics. So the origins of the neoclassical framework and the marginalism after the turn of the century, so early 20th century, as really a moment in which the class nature of our economics discipline today is quite visible. And so it's more interesting to explore it because it reveals features that are more normalized today.
Are you optimistic about the future of, I don't know how to call this, but I guess the history of ideas, or just an approach that pays more attention to intellectual history in the discipline? I'm asking you this because, I mean, although you describe like your position as a minoritarian one, I mean, you've also been benefited by the huge success that like your book has had, right? So how do you think about that? Like, is that a sign of hope or?
Two things here. One is that the history of economic thought, the history of economics as a sub-discipline is also in many ways, I think, methodologically quite conservative. So there are history of economics societies, but they tend to detach the theory of the authors from the actual social context in which these economists operated. And so my work was criticized heavily also from the, you know, the societies in which I did participate in, the conference I did go to with were the Conference of the History of Economic Thought, because they saw what I was doing as not really what the historian of economic thought should do, which is all about kind of an internal reconstruction of ideas, very much in a Lakatosian framework. So I must say that I also felt quite not always understood also amongst the history of economic thought society community. This said, I think we are in a historical moment in which there's a lot of thirst for new narratives. There's a lot of obvious signs of why our current socioeconomic system is failing us. I don't need to, so obvious, just the climate crisis, the socioeconomic inequality crisis, and so forth. So that new narratives are clearly welcome. I think it's interesting to note that my book is published with the University of Chicago Press, which is the press that published Hayek and Friedman. And if you go on their web, on their page, the related titles to my work are in fact Hayek and Friedman, which is at once, you know, I'm very honored by the fact of even being, you know, put together with such famous economists. But at the same time, it also shows clearly the two texts are could not be more different in terms of the message. My work tries to deconstruct the consensus towards our economic system, while of course Hayek and Friedman were the major ideologues in support of our society in terms of market capitalism. So I think this that there is hope in the sense that it seems to me that there is interest to publish new things, both from prestigious traditional university presses. And it has received a lot of attention because clearly I think people realize how political so the role of a historian is. I think that this is something I take on very seriously, is to really live the political weight of the profession, not just of the economist, but also of the historian. How historians reconstruct the past has enormous impact and influence on how we can imagine the future, right? So the how you see the past, the trajectory you tell, the story you tell about the history of capitalism is very important to justify the present and so avoid thinking of alternatives for the future. So the idea of the book is exactly to look at the workings of capitalism in more realistic terms rather than idealized terms, look at the fact that austerity, the thesis of the book is that austerity is in the DNA of capitalism and that we should talk more about austerity capitalism rather than neoliberalism, because neoliberalism gives a sense of the exception to a rule. And the idea is quite the opposite here. The idea is that the rule is austerity. And this is something I think people are interested in hearing because they also want to think about alternatives that are not necessarily just going back to a welfare capitalism moment.
Let's get into the, I guess, the details of your argument, and for doing that, I would like to hear how you understand austerity, right? And what I'm thinking is like, it's austerity versus what? Like, what's like the other alternative? So what I'm thinking is that, I guess, that in concrete terms, I can think about a policy that follows austerity, right? That one's one that has to, that tries, for instance, to have like a fiscal surplus. So is it non-austerity, something where you have like zero fiscal surplus, or you need to have like a fiscal deficit? How big does it need to be? Like, how do you, I know you do it and you have a rather complex idea of what austerity is, but I would like to hear, how do you react to like those thoughts?
Yes. So the intention of the capital order was to repoliticize the austerity debates, which goes on both in the public domain, but also among scholars. So how to repoliticize austerity is exactly one way is to stop thinking about austerity just as a toolbox to manage the economy, and especially to stop thinking in the aggregate. So I think I wanted to get out of the dichotomy of pro-austerity economist and Keynesian criticisms to austerity that viewed austerity, the opposite of austerity, of just fiscal stimulus in general, right? So what you described to me is, doesn't really get to the crux of what austerity is, and thus doesn't get to the crux of what a non-austerity framework would look like, because we shouldn't think in the aggregate. This is why I talk about austerity policies as being fundamentally a trinity of policies, fiscal, monetary, and industrial. And these policies really have the fundamental function of shifting resources from the majority of us, so the working people, to the restricted minority of the saving, investing elite, right? So in this sense, if you look at the budget of Italy, for example, given that I'm here right now, we now had a new budget law passed, and total expenditures didn't go down. But the point is, where is the state spending? And how is the state making its revenue? So the state is now increasing its military expenditure, okay, by quite a lot, actually, by 300 million just in this year. But at the same time, it's cutting, 800 million just this year. But at the same time, it's cutting on, for example, healthcare, 300 million a year, and on public schools, and on many other benefits. For example, we had an income for the poor, which has been eliminated. So here we see that if you look at the total amount of expenditure of the state, we don't really see what's going on. What we need to do is actually disaggregate in terms of analysis of classes, where is the money spent? And clearly what we see is that austerity is always about taking away benefits and social resources from the majority. And this is, again, not a mistake. The thesis of the book is that it is exactly austerity that serves the purpose of enhancing capital accumulation, of stabilizing our capitalist economy and the very possibility of economic growth, because it forces people to accept our capitalist economy as the only one possible. How? Very concretely, by, for example, privatizing all what were before social benefits that you could just be entitled to as a citizen, for example, school and healthcare. In the moment in which this becomes private and you need to purchase these rights, then you depend more and more on the market. And we know that if you depend on the market, and if the labor market is unfavorable, and this is what austerity does, we see it right now today, is the increasing interest rates have exactly the purpose of increasing the pool of the unemployed. In a situation in which we depend on the market for survival and unemployment is high, this creates competition amongst us for survival, and thus fundamentally the necessity to accept the social order and be disciplined by these impersonal laws of the market. So this is, I hope I answered in the sense that for me, the issue is that austerity needs to be understood as a one-sided class warfare against the people in order to support capitalism as the only game in town that people just need to accept out of no other possibility. And thus the idea that economic policy is synonymous with austerity because there's no other possibility around.
So you argue, you want to point out in the book that austerity, as you define it, emerges or consolidates after World War One, right? Why don't you tell us a bit about that process and more specifically, how were things before then, right? If that's the origin of it, what's the before and the after of the austerity story here?
Thank you. The thesis of the capital order is that in order to understand the logic of austerity today, one needs to look at austerity's origins. Why look at the austerity's origins? Well, because austerity, I argue, emerges in a moment in which capitalism was confronting its greatest existential crisis, in which the capital order, that's the title of the book, the capital order was being questioned and was shaking. Now, just to be clear, why the capital order? I kind of already said it, but I would like to be more explicit. The capital order refers to capital, which usually we understand as a commodity, as wealth, as something separate from us. This capital as a commodity, as wealth, as what in fact our system is meant to produce, our system is meant to invest capital in order to gain more capital, and this is in fact the definition of economic growth, in order for our system to grow economically, we require capital as the social relation that organizes our society by which the majority of us willingly, in quotes, in the sense that there's no real other option, sells its labor power in return for a wage. So the pillar of our economic system, the pillar of capital growth and of economic growth is wage relations, our wage relations, in the sense that it's the fact that the majority of us survives because it is able to get some cash in the wallet thanks to working for a wage, right? And it is this working for a wage for private employers, usually, and that's why the other big pillar of the capital order is private property of the means of production, in the sense that this economic growth happens because private investors invest. Okay, so what happens? With the Great War, First World War, 1914-1918, this capital order really is put into question for the first time. And why does this happen? Well, it happens, and I explained through extensive historical and archival work, it happens because the state, for the first time, breaches its what was considered the natural limit of its action so far, because it actually needs to massively intervene in the market in order to assure victory, in order to assure enough war production to win the war. So war collectivism, the fact that the state becomes the main employer and the main producer, has the effect of repoliticizing these pillars of capital accumulation, namely wage relations and private property of the means of production. What do I mean by repoliticizing? Very simply put, that citizens in, and I focus on Western Europe, I focus on Italy and Britain during and after the war, namely that citizens, not just in Eastern Europe, but also in Western Europe, in the cradle of liberal democracy, Britain, the most advanced capitalist country in that moment, start thinking that a different society may be possible with the war reconstruction, right? So the sense, and this is, again, I give voice to the people living in that moment. And that's a big effort of the first part of the book, is to reconstruct this existential crisis of capitalism by using primary sources. So really trying to get back to the spirit of the time, in which, of course, now with the benefit of hindsight, we know that capitalism remains solid. But people living in 1919 in Britain and Italy, and of course, in other places of the world as well, really were thinking that the system was not going to survive more than a couple of years. And of course, we had the Russian Revolution happening not very far away, to keep in mind that it was a revolutionary context. So in this revolutionary momentum, and the first part of the book described the varieties of practical alternatives that were maturing and being put into motion, from a more reformist understanding of putting social necessities before economic necessities. So kind of a Keynesianism before Keynes, much more radical in its ambition to emancipate the majority through, for example, communal homes, spaces for maternity, women to be emancipated from it, their reproduction work, and adult education and so forth, all the way to much more ambitious understanding of economic democracy based on self-governance of industry and of also of agricultural production. So I go through a whole variety of possibilities, guild socialism, the workers' council movement that was very strong in Italy in 1920, the occupation of the factories that lasted a whole month, in which the whole peninsula workers were, in fact, through these council, organizing production democratically. This is the idea. The idea is that it is in this moment of existential crisis of the capital order that the elite has to use its most powerful tools to react in order to maintain, protect the capital order from imminent defeat. And it is the second part of the book that thus reconstructs austerity as this global technocratic project in which economic experts were called upon by governments of all around the world. I focus again just on two countries, but it was really quite a global, through these new international financial conferences, the first international financial conferences in Brussels 1920 and Genoa 1922, in which the austerity code is refined and is wielded in the motto that they use themselves at the time. Again, I use the sources to really have these people speak directly. Consume less, produce more. Thus, the requirement to impose austerity on the population of Europe. I look at Britain and Italy, because these two contexts that were very different politically, we have a liberal state, parliamentary democracy again in Britain, and we have a nascent fascist regime in Italy. 1922 is the year in which Mussolini comes to power. And what we see, interestingly, and this is a provocative message of the book, is that once we put austerity at the center of our analysis, what you see is that in a liberal world and in a fascist world, the type of class warfare that was going on in order to protect the capital order was stunningly similar. Similar in the type of policies that were being enacted, and similar in the type of economic theory that was justifying austerity. This is why for me austerity is not just economic policy, it's not just the trinity of fiscal, monetary, and industrial policy, which shifts resources from the majority to the minority, but it's also about the type of economic theory that justifies this distribution of resources.
I mean, I'm going to ask you more about the similarities and differences between your two cases. But before that, I would like to take and go a bit further into something that you mentioned, which was the Bolshevik Revolution, right? How important was that in that, how important was it in this process? Do you think that the idea that this other type of society was feasible and that a political project of that such was feasible because it literally happened and it seemed to work somewhat fine, at least I guess for that period of time, was important? Like how important compared with the word effort was this? I don't know. How do you think about this?
Yes. Yes. I was criticized because for some scholars, and I agree, I didn't give enough weight to the importance of what was going on in Eastern Europe and namely Russia. So I didn't do that because, of course, I was more focused in looking at what was emerging in the hub of advanced capitalism in that historical moment. But definitely what you see from all the archival sources I found is that it had a galvanizing effect on the working classes in Britain and Italy, what was going on in Russia, right? So the Daily Herald, one of the newspapers I explore, which was the critical lefty newspaper in Britain, they had always this interest that really fomented the revolutionary fervor also in Britain. And this was also true in Italy, l'Ordine Nuovo of Gramsci, Togliatti, that was the intellectual space of the factory council movement, was always reporting what was going on in Russia, not just Russia, in Germany with Rosa Luxemburg, in Hungary. So clearly ideas were circulating globally, not just the austerity ideas that were the reaction to this revolution, but also the revolutionary ideas. Now we need to consider, and this is very important, that the beginning, the 1918-1919 phase of Soviet Russia was very different from the phase Soviet Russia took. For example, even in 1922 with the NEP and the need for Russia to confront also the opposition coming from the West and the fundamental verticalization and the imposition of kind of an authoritarian state on the population in Russia, because the initial project was in fact based on the Soviets as the space of economic democracy, economic and political democracy, which is exactly the inspiration point of what was happening in the Shop-Stuart movement in Britain and in the Council movement in Italy, which was, let's stop pretending we have democracy in a capitalist representative system, because you cannot have political democracy if this is not grounded in economic democracy. And by this, they meant, again, overcoming wage relations, overcoming the idea that we need to go to work, we're forced to work in return for a wage, and we have no control over the production process or over the output of production. And we just need to accept a low wage as human beings, but the idea that actually we can become all collectively producers. So this is an intuition from Gramsci, who's very important in my first part of the book, is that you can imagine a society that really overcomes the divisions of classes by imagining the fact that we can all become collectively producers in the sense that we are all participating democratically in the production and distribution of resources. And it's only in this vindication of agency of the people that you can really think about a possibility of a new state that is not alienated from the people. It's not oppressive, like what happened then in the Soviet Union after, but it's actually the expression of the people, right? So this idea that it's a new state because it's the expression of the democratic productive processes. So in that historical moment, 1918-1919, this was the inspiration that was coming from the East. It was about economic democracy, which of course did not last long for a variety of reasons that my book does not explore. But the point is that there were serious attempts to put into practice an alternative that was a virtuous alternative, which was not an oppressive. It was not. I got mentioned on the Financial Times in the best books of 2022, and Wolf, who is writes the piece, he said there can. It's very interesting because it's undeniable that there cannot be nothing apart from capitalism that is not dictatorship and stagnation. This is how he concludes kind of the presentation of the book, which of course this is kind of the end of history perspective that we have all kind of internalized as citizens of this world. But honestly speaking, there are at the time in the 1919-1920, clearly the idea was not that either you had capitalism or you had dictatorship, but that actually capitalism itself was authoritarian and oppressive, and thus you needed to think about something different.
I would like to hear now a bit more about how this played on the ground in the cases that you studied. So you focus on Britain and Italy. Who were the people and the names behind this counteroffensive, I guess, that were behind the consolidation of austerity as an important narrative that had to be embraced? Tell us a bit about that, please.
So interesting, because the first international financial conferences were really a moment, again, in Brussels, 1920, Genoa, 1922, were really a moment in which experts had a high moment for themselves, in the sense that they were called to, for the first time, advise governments. And what I do is that I look at specifically who was operating in Britain. And I focus in Britain on the experts at the British Treasury and also of the Bank of England. And then the experts, the equivalent experts in Italy that were economic professors who were diffusing the novel paradigm called of pure economics. Now, pure economics is what they called their own framework, which was this framework that was basically the foundation of mainstream economics still today, emerging out of the so-called marginalist revolution. Pure economics, because the idea was that economics had finally reached a stage that was a mature, hard science that thus could really eliminate all the biases, all the class implications, and could be neutral and above parts. Now, of course, the book plays exactly with this paradox, or more than a paradox, exactly with the importance of claiming this neutrality of the expert in a moment in which you want to have people accept these oppressive austerity policies. So to go back to your question, I look at Ralph Hawtrey in Britain has a huge role because he's the British Treasury expert who was actually coming up with the first macroeconomic theory that then was very influential on Keynes himself and on the Chicago School of Economics, so the monetarist tradition. And his influence on his Treasury experts and how this kind of took concrete forms in the policies the Chancellor of the Exchequer was implementing. In fact, Ralph Hawtrey was the in-house economist. He wrote extensive memos that I dug up from the archives in the Kew Gardens archives, but also the Churchill archives in Cambridge. All these memoranda Hawtrey wrote to directly advise the chancellor on the best austerity policies, namely cuts in social expenditures, regressive taxation, so the fact that they started taxing the general population with the idea that they were consuming too much and cutting taxes on the virtuous saver investors, and finally extensive privatization, wage repression. So all of these policies justified by a new economic theory. And this was the same in Italy. Pantaleoni, Maffeo Pantaleoni is a big protagonist. He was one of the founders of the marginalist framework, pure economics, to the levels of, you know, people like Jevons and Valras. He's very famous in his principles of pure economics. And he was participating in the Mussolini cabinet in order to see his models concretely applied, right? The possibility finally of these pure economists to reach their dream of modeling society according to their mathematical abstractions.
I mean, you addressed some of this already, and I know there's like a conceptual or philosophical approach to this, but I would like to hear how do you react to, like, from a more like practical approach to the fact that after like this ideas consolidate, you have like a widespread adoption of the idea that the state should play a larger role in economy, right? And then, so what I'm trying to say is that at least the conventional story is that Keynes arrives and he charms everyone. Well, I guess that, well, there are a bunch of like determinants behind, but by many means, most people would argue that you see the expansion of the welfare state and the expansion of the size of the government, their intervention in the economy, and so on and so forth. How do you see that fitting into your theory, right? Is that a pushback or is this part of the same long-term trend and these are disguised like actors of the system? How do you think about this?
Thank you. It's a very important question. John Maynard Keynes is himself a character in the story I tell in The Capital Order. He's a character not central, peripheral, but present. And it's interesting to note that in the early 1920s, Keynes, just as much as his austere colleagues, was terrified by the possibility of the collapse of the capital order. So in the early 1920s, he is the one who's actually advocating for even higher interest rate hikes than his colleagues. And he's also advocating for another very important austerity pillar, which is central bank independence. This work delves into how it is actually through the active de-democratization process of decision-making, of economic decision-making, that austerity is successful. And someone like Keynes was very well aware that in a moment in which there was a general enfranchisement of the population and people were demanding a greater say in economic decisions, it was more than ever crucial to maintain the insulation of the expert in its capacity to make decision on its own. And as Hawtrey put it, the Bank of England should have never explained, never apologize, and never regretted, right? These are the words. Someone like Keynes was very much agreeing with. So the Keynes that is never talked about is the Keynes of the early 1920s, who was an austerity supporter. And this, though, Keynes never really repudiates, because if you read what he writes still in the 1940s, 1942, he says, he's asked, and this is again, this document is in the archives, and he was asked to reassess his positions, and he said, I would have done exactly the same, because he says, the boom, not the bust, is the moment for austerity, and especially more than the boom, it's the moment of social disorder, the moment in which people are wanting to overcome the pillars of capitalism is a moment in which austerity is more than ever necessary. And this is understanding that in order to avoid the thin crust, the breakdown of the thin crust of civilization, which he equates to capitalist civilization, because as the austerity people, he doesn't think there's anything but rationality in the terms of capitalist rationality and civilization in the terms of capitalist civilization. He's very clear that austerity is necessary in order to stabilize class relations. And this is something that he understands Keynes is very aware of where he stands in the class warfare. In fact, he says it, right? In this moment, I stand with the educated bourgeoisie. He's very explicit, and so are the others. And that's why I find very interesting to look at these characters of the 1920s, that they're much more explicit than today. Than someone like Larry Summers today, for example, even if also today the explicit need to discipline consumers and producers is quite clear, honestly. But anyway, this said, what about the larger intervention of the state that we see in the 1930s, for example, right? That was kind of your question. How do we make sense of this in this general thesis of the book, which is that capitalism is really austerity capitalism? So I would say that the possibility of large-scale state intervention that happened mostly to recover from the Great Slump after 1929, and parenthesis, austerity was used as a main formula to cure even the downturn of the 1930s until well into the 1930s, right? But anyway, I think that realized Keynesianism was possible because it stood in the ashes of the successes of austerity. Let me try to explain. I think that the class stabilization that austerity allowed for in the 1920s was what enabled the possibility of having state interventionism in the 1930s without this implying the general questioning of the capital order. So the stabilization of the capital order in the 1920s set the basis for the possibility of a Keynesian state interventionism, which was not going to fundamentally shake the foundation of capitalist growth. The workers had been defeated. The Keynesianism, Fordism of post-Second World War was a situation in which the working classes had ultimately accepted the capitalist social contract. So they, of course, they wanted higher wages, but they were not going to question what was instead questioned after the First World War, which were wage relations themselves. So I think this is important, is that even Keynesianism, this is what I'm working on for my new book project that is still very much in the making, is to look about to look at how much Keynesianism actually presupposes austerity capitalism, both chronologically and structurally. Because in the early 1920s, last thing I want to say is that chapter two of my book, of the Capital Order, reconstructs the worldview of the so-called reconstructionists. Sorry, the play with words. Reconstructionists, which were in fact trying to pacify the general social upheaval after the First World War with proto-Keynesian measures. And what is obvious is that this reconstructionist aim was achieving non-reconstructionist results in the sense that people were demanding more. This giving social resources to the population was actually entailing greater demands from this population to break away from the system in general, right? So the impossibility of social appeasement through social measures after the First World War is something that, of course, is very different in the state interventionism afterwards.
I would like to take some of what you mentioned, and I know that you have the expectation that your thesis can enlighten some of our present conditions. So I would like to take like a bit this conversation to the present, and I would like to ask you, how do you see the future regarding this same issue? I'd like, my impression would have been till a few months ago that mainstream economics had become quite sympathetic towards something that probably is not exactly what you understand as austerity, but towards something against like the dominant like austerity view of the last few decades, right? So I had in the podcast a few months ago, Barry Eichengreen, he wrote a book called In Defense of Public Debt, for instance, right? And I think you could argue that he's part of the establishment, if you want, of the profession, right? He's at UC Berkeley, and many people, and no one thought like, okay, this is very crazy. I know, again, that you don't see austerity as a purely macro policy, I guess, or like fiscal monetary policy. But like that sense, like that would have been like my reading of the situation back then. Things have changed recently, right? So, but anyways, I would like to hear how you think about this. Are you somewhat optimistic? Do you think that things are changing? They're not. What do you think about this?
Yes, I think this is very interesting because ultimately, I think that these recent months have really uncovered the facade of supposed Keynesianism as an alternative to austerity that we were convinced had happened, let's say, with even the COVID pandemic. What we see today is that even authors, even in the book of Barry Akingreen, it is very clear that there's clear limits to social expenditures, especially, and especially when you reach the structural limit of capitalism, which is the inflationary risks. So what we see today, right? So Keynesians of all sorts, new Keynesians, post-Keynesians, even someone like Stephanie Kelton, I mean, ultimately realize that inflation is a true risk for the system. Monetary instability, if there's no monetary stability, capitalism doesn't function. But as Keynes himself saw in the 1920s, inflation is also a deeply political problem, right? So inflation is clearly what allows us to see that there's nothing just economic. It's always also political, in the sense that inflationism threatens the breakdown of the consensus of the market capitalist economy as the most efficient way to organize our society. It enhances social unrest. It enhances labor mobilization, all the strikes we're seeing, right? In the United States, there are plenty of strikes that the mainstream media doesn't discuss, but we're in a moment in which, if you look at the Cornell Labor Actions Tracker, you see real time these strikes going on. There's more than 800 strikes taking place all over the country. Britain is huge amount of labor mobilization going on. Why? Well, because inflation triggers discontent and triggers a possibility of thinking about potentially a way of organizing society that is different. Now, the mainstream now is ultimately New Keynesian, right? The mainstream New Keynesian view clearly does not allow for breaching away from the capital order. So as soon as there are threats to the fundamental basis of our capitalist economic growth, they also revert to austerity. And quite explicitly, right? Again, someone like Larry Summers, who you could say like kind of embodies this mainstream, who clearly is not opposed to state intervention as such, right? We know that all of these economists were very much favorable to especially business stimulus during moments of recession, especially. So this, again, we see that this is not counter to the logic of austerity, because as I explain in the book, austerity is about where you want to use your state resources. If you decide that the best way to boost and protect economic growth under capitalism, maybe we lost a moment.
Yes, but go ahead. We can.
So what I was saying is that even state interventionism is not counter in itself to the austerity logic. Because if you look at what happened to stimulate the economy, for example, with the COVID pandemic, it was all about giving the priority to the saver investing elite in all of the money that was wielded towards the supposed productive sectors of the economy, right? To the people, very little was given in this form of paycheck. So state interventionism itself is not counter necessarily to the austerity logic. The point, again, is to look at where the state spends. And if the state is spending on the saving investing elite, that is exactly the logic of austerity. And you can see clearly that when limits are being breached, in the sense that maybe people did get more consumption power because of these stimulus checks. And this consumption power has, in fact, somehow threatened monetary stability. Or in general, these stimulus checks have, most importantly, allowed people to realize that there could be an alternative to just going to work for a wage. There's a huge anti-work movement in the United States right now. People just not going to work anymore, right? The Great Resignation is real, and it's what actually is pushing up labor costs because workers now have higher bargaining power because the labor market is so tight. And the labor market is tight because millions of Americans, just in August, 4.3 million Americans stop going to work. So this, I think, is very important, is that when all of this disorder of the social relation of production happen, then the Keynesian mainstream has no doubt that the solution to this crisis is very tough austerity. First of all, in the form of interest rate hikes. And they say it explicitly, interest rate hikes will cool down the economy, will increase the unemployment rate. Someone like Ray Summers is saying we need a 7% unemployment rate in order for our economy to run smoothly. So once you have this understanding of what austerity is, and again, the point of this book is to give a different reading of austerity, exactly to have us kind of question these usual dichotomies of who is austere and who isn't, and just understanding Keynesianism as in principle, not austere. I would argue that Keynesianism in many forms is austere if we understand austerity through a class lens.
Let me ask you one final question, which I mean, I expect it to be unfair, because your book is very concrete. I think you want to deliver one specific message and you do it like quite effectively, but it's fundamentally a story, a Eurocentric story, right? It's or like a West like type of narrative, right? And I'm curious about how do you think about what happens in the rest of the world, right? How, like, now I'm talking from Colombia, I'm visiting my parents, I just told you. What are the roles of these places? And are we just the periphery? And here, like, I'm thinking up just about the developing world, but I'm thinking about places like China nowadays, or that I guess like you could put it also as a developing country, but what are these places, what's the place of these countries in your story? And maybe you're gonna tell me, well, this is the periphery, the ideas emerge in the core of the capitalist system and then they spread across the rest of the world. But if that's the case, I would like to hear, what are the mechanisms through which that happens? Is there any point where you see that there's a counterbalance movement that could emerge from these other places as they have become wealthier in recent decades? What's your read on these issues?
Yes, thank you. So just to be clear, the reason why I focused on Italy and Britain, even in my historical case study, was because it was there that legal equality had been achieved, right? And so it was a moment in which, in fact, you really see austerity as this project to avoid economic democracy, to avoid democratic participation, in a moment in which, at least legally, formally speaking, democratic participation had been reached. This is why I don't look at, for example, what was going on in the colonies, not because there was no austerity, but because in a way there was still an even deeper political subjugation that was not really allowing for people to use their political enfranchisement for alternative economic systems, demands for alternative economic systems. So that's why I'm looking at the West. I'm looking at the West because I want to look at internal class warfare. And so I think what I tried to do in the last chapter of the book is to try to show how the themes that emerge from this scrutiny of the class dynamics within the Western Europe, of course, ultimately apply, and I don't want to say that we should, of course, I very well know the critique also of, you know, the emergence of neoliberalism as something that happened in the West and then was transported in the rest of the world, right? That the kind of David Harvey reading, which has been amply criticized, rightfully so, regarding the birth of neoliberalism. So the same kind of could be said of my book, but the point here is not to say the practices that were born here and then transposed, but it's more to say, let's look at these dynamics and mechanisms that show up constantly in the history of capitalism globally, and how do they play out? And so that's why the last chapter also, for example, shows clear parallelism between the Mussolini dictatorship and the support of liberals of Mussolini with what was happening in Pinochet with the case of Pinochet in the 1970s, and also what happened with Boris Yeltsin in the 1990s in after the fall of the Soviet Union. So dynamics that are not just in the West, they're everywhere. And they play out differently, of course, according to the different contexts. But certainly the authoritarian thrust of economic expertise used to justify austerity is something that you see in all countries all over the world. So that's why for me it's important to kind of stress the relevance of class analysis, also because it plays out constantly. And of course, then austerity is pressured from, I mean, hegemonic countries are pressuring other countries to impose austerity even further. So the role of the IMF, for example, now in Sri Lanka, or just even the role that the European Troika plays in Italy or Greece. So, you know, periphery at all levels, the periphery of Europe and the periphery, the global periphery and the global South. Clearly, there is national pressures from the part of the most of the North to impose austerity. So it's fair to look at the nation, national units. But I also think that the part of the book is to say, if we have as our unit of analysis nation states and countries, we lose sight of what is more important, which is the class struggle that happened at all levels, both domestically and internationally, right? So this, I think, is something, for example, that dependency theory saw very well in discussing the situation in Latin America after the Second World War, is that you need to keep class analysis in mind even when you're looking at relations between countries.
This is great. This is quite fascinating. I think this was a lovely conversation. I learned a lot reading your book. You wrote a quite thought-provoking book, and I want to thank you for that. I want to thank you for your time. Thanks a lot, Clara.
Thank you so much for having me, and I hope the listeners will be curious enough to read the direct sources of the time in the book.
Okay. Bye-bye.